County's two best players did what they were expected to do Thursday at the WIAA State Individual Girls Tennis Tournament. The rest of the county's state qualifiers, unfortunately, will be going home. Westosha Central senior Gwen Hammond and Indian Trail senior Lainey Ristow both reached the third round of Division I singles on the first day of the three-day tournament at the Nielsen Tennis Stadium in Madison. Taking a look at our weather, we can expect a high today in the mid-50s. We can also expect some rain later in the afternoon. For tonight, rain will continue in the evening, probably until about 9 p.m. Our lows will be in the mid-30s. And for tomorrow, mostly sunny. Highs will be in the low 50s, and tomorrow night, partly cloudy skies with lows near 40. You're listening to WGTD-HD, where we have news in the morning four times an hour.
And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am very, very excited on today's morning show to be reconnecting with best-selling writer Paul Sexton, who has written extensively on subjects related to music. And he and I spoke approximately a year ago about his wonderful book called Prince, A Portrait of the Artist in Memories and Memorabilia. And today, we're going to be talking about one of the most notable members of one of the most notable rock bands in history, the Rolling Stones. We'll be talking about their incredible drummer, Charlie Watts. And Paul Sexton has written a thorough, illuminating, and affectionate biography of Charlie Watts, which is called Charlie's Good Tonight, The Life, the Times, and the Rolling Stones, the authorized biography of Charlie Watts. And as we will explore, Paul Sexton had the opportunity to speak with a number of members of the band, of the Rolling Stones, and others very closely involved in the activities of that band over the course of many, many decades, of course, leaving an incredible, indelible imprint upon the world of music that will certainly last forever. And the role that the quiet and dignified Charlie Watts played in all of that is beautifully explored in this fascinating book. It's published by HarperCollins, again titled Charlie's Good Tonight, The Life, the Times, and the Rolling Stones, the authorized biography of Charlie Watts. Paul Sexton, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Hello, Greg. It's great to be with you again so soon.
Yes, I'm just delighted to be speaking with you. I want to say in the interest of full disclosure that I am somebody that does not come to this as a longtime fan of the Rolling Stones. I have certainly been interested in them from afar and have followed their story to some extent. I mean, even if you're not a rock fan, how could one miss this phenomenon? Coming to your book, I knew essentially nothing at all about Charlie Watts. And I came away from your book just thoroughly fascinated by this intriguing gentleman and very gifted musician.
Great. It's great to hear that. You know, in a way, it's almost more interesting to hear the opinion of someone who is, you know, is not an expert, Greg. You know, just coming at it from a different direction, maybe, than someone, you know, which would be most people, I suppose, who would come to it with as big fans.
So, tell us about your own personal connection with the Rolling Stones over the years. I mean, obviously, you've been a fan and somebody who has, as a music journalist, have followed them very, very closely. But what about on more of a personal level? And in particular, what was your personal connection with Charlie Watts ahead of writing this biography of him?
Well, I guess just to backtrack very slightly, I've been a music writer all my adult life, basically. I started writing for one of the music papers in the UK when I was still at school, age 17. So it occurred to me that in a couple of months' time, I will reach yet another ridiculous anniversary of 45 years of getting away with it and writing about music. And I would say that for the probably about 30-ish of those years, I've been doing interviews and lots of other things with the Stones, which started, I think actually the very first connection was an interview with Bill Wyman when he was still in the band in the late 80s.
And he would be their bass player. And,
yeah, that's right.
And somebody who had quite a close connection with Charlie Watts.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, very good friends. You know, I mean, the interconnections between any and all of the members of this band are just fascinating to see. And you're right, Bill and Charlie were particularly close, and he was gracious enough to talk to me for the book, and that really underlined that, as indeed, you know, those relationships were underlined with all of the his bandmates. But the first time I ever met Charlie was in 1991, when he was promoting a jazz release. Actually, it was sort of in between the Stones records. And I just found him to be fascinating, engaging, modest, unusual in every respect, you know, just about the most atypical rock star you could possibly meet. And it just began what turned out to be, you know, this very long run of interviews with all of the band. The first time I interviewed Mick and Keith would have been a little while after that, in the mid-90s, I think. And, you know, without ever, you know, in one's role as a journalist, I don't think you'd ever dare to say that you become close friends. But, you know, if you get asked back the next time, then that's some kind of a compliment, and I've been, you know, lucky enough for that to happen to me just repeatedly for all of these decades ever since, and, you know, interviewed them on pretty much every new record or tour, every reissue increasingly in recent years, and filled all kinds of roles, you know, whether it's been writing about them for newspapers or magazines or making radio programs about them, often doing promotional interview material for them, for the band themselves. So, you know, you do whatever's asked, of course, and it's just such a wonderful world to have a small part in.
Mm. So just to kind of lurch ahead briefly to, in a sense, the end of the story of Charlie Watts, he passed away in late August last year, so late August 2021. At yep. that point in time, were you already at work on this biography of Charlie Watts, or was your sort of concerted work on this prompted by his death?
Well, we've been in discussion about it for quite a long time by that point. The initial discussions actually go back a year previous to that, dating back to a feature that I wrote about the Stones for a British newspaper, the Sunday Times, which was around one of the reissues. As I say, I think it was the Goat's Head Soup album deluxe package that came out, for which I interviewed Mick and Keith again and various others. And I had an approach from a publisher at HarperCollins who was very interested in the original idea of an autobiography. The idea would have been me working with Charlie on his own memoir. But I always had some reservations about that because, as I say, he was such a modest man that it's the sort of thing that he would never have done. He just wouldn't have put pen to paper in the way that most you know, famous rock musicians do. So, you know, discussions continued for quite a long time. Obviously, COVID came along and got in the way. He, a little later on from that, became rather poorly. And we, obviously in very sad circumstances, we kind of revisited the idea soon after his passing and tried to think if there was a respectful way of doing a biography of him, which, you know, from a journalistic point of view, made a lot more sense, really, to be able to talk to all of his friends and colleagues about him. And that's exactly how it came together, you know, and the actual writing of it was quite fast. You know, it's kind of hurry up and wait in the world of the Rolling Stones. You know, it takes a long time to get any idea over the line, and then suddenly it's rush, rush, rush. That's kind of the way it works on this one.
Right. So as you say, kind of repeatedly in the book, Charlie Watts is, in a sense, the polar opposite of what one thinks of as a rock star. And at one point you call him the most reluctant star in all of music. I mean, just not interested in the wild trappings that are so quickly associated with lots of professional music making at that level of excellence, but particularly in the world of rock and roll. Is that what, in a sense, drew you to want to craft a full biography of him, because he was, in a sense, such an unlikely figure in that world? Or were there other things that were even more important to you in terms of a reason to give this kind of attention to him?
I think what you described is, you know, had an awful lot to do with it in terms of being attracted to the idea. And obviously, having interviewed him so many times over a very long period, the opportunity to pay tribute really to him was absolutely irresistible. And one of the important aspects in the discussions that we had leading into it was, when the idea cropped up in the first place, I was asked about whether I want to do it, and I said only with the the approval really of the band and Charlie himself, of course. And I was so delighted that we were able to get the authorization of his family for the book, and who are every bit as private as Charlie is. You know, you never hear anything about them at all. It's quite a small, close-knit family. But Charlie's daughter, Serafina, and his granddaughter, Charlotte, both graciously gave their permission and are, in the book, spoke to me for it, along with Charlie's sister, Linda, who is 3 years Charlie's junior and has never spoken about him on the record to anyone. So that was a massive compliment that she would take part in it. And I think, yes, that's really the thing that attracted me was that, and the idea that, everyone knows something about Charlie, but no one knows everything about him. He's one of those very unusual figures who has not been, over-reported, really, and certainly in terms of his private life and his other interests, which I hope are, come through in the book. So you have this very, virtuous situation in a way where you start out with a great deal of goodwill towards him. Everyone loved Charlie, basically, and no one had a bad word to say about him. But lots of people don't know that much about him, so there was plenty of material to explore. That was, a great sort of challenge and pleasure as a writer.
Hmm. And I think it says something both about you as well as Charlie Watts and how he was regarded that your book includes a foreword written by Mick Jagger and another foreword written by Keith Richards. I mean, clearly they thought highly not only of you and this project, but probably even most importantly, thought so highly of their former bandmate and friend, Charlie Watts.
That's exactly right, and that is a theme, that a thread really that ran through all of the new interviews that I did for the book, in addition to, a pretty vast archive of my own interviews and other people's as well, and quotes from newspapers and articles going all the way back to the beginning of the band. Everybody just was kind of falling over themselves to be part of this. Everyone was so gracious and cooperative and, generous with their time, because he was their mate. That's what it boils down to, really. And everyone looked up to him in a way that he would have, I can hear him now kind of saying, what's all this fuss about? He just would never have volunteered for it. He would have run away in the other direction, I think. But that's part of his charm, really. And it's just such an unusual quality in rock and roll that, it wasn't an affectation in any way. He was just about as ordinary a person as you could imagine. But obviously with some unusual sort of foibles and habits and so on that were only made him more endearing. So that's what people wanted to talk about, I think, and that was certainly true of Mick and Keith and Ronnie and Bill Wyman and, lots of other people who were sort of in important part of the Stones orbit, whether it's Glyn Johns, who engineered their records for so long, or Chris Kimsey, who produced some of the later albums, or, past and present bandmates, personal friends, his tailor, his shoemaker, because this Charlie was, of course, a man of great style. So, it was important to have some people that were not just from his music background.
Because there certainly was a lot more to him than just his music. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with best-selling writer Paul Sexton about his latest book, which is called Charlie's Good Tonight, The Life, The Times, The Rolling Stones, the authorized biography of Charlie Watts. Charlie Watts was the drummer for the Rolling Stones decade after decade after decade, and achieved a remarkable place in music history. I appreciate the time that you take talking about his modest upbringings, his happy childhood, and the fact that Charlie Watts was someone who was, as a young person, interested in art, maybe even more than music, and he was also a great athlete. So there's all kinds of things that are, that's a lot more than meets the eye when it comes to Charlie Watts.
Yes, that's right. He was good at sports at school. He was extremely good at graphic design. He wasn't great at much else. You know, he left school with only one qualification, really, but he looked for quite some time as though he was going to go into a career in graphic design. That was his first job, and indeed that's what he was doing at the point where he began to be noticed as a very talented drummer on the jazz circuit originally, or jazz and R&B, I suppose you'd say at that point. So yes, his life could have gone in a very different direction if he hadn't made those connections when he did. And the skill in design is something that would serve him well in later years. He did various bits of artwork for various Stones releases. If anyone knows the album Between the Buttons from the kind of around the mid '60s, the cartoons on the back cover of that record were done by Charlie. He did a Christmas card one time for the band, and in much later on, he and Mick worked together very closely on the design of their amazing, enormous stage sets in the stadium years. And that's one of those things that, again, not a lot of people knew that. Serafina, his daughter, is particularly proud of that because it really brought his graphic design skills to bear in a way that made for these unforgettable, amazing shows that they put on. So yeah, the man of many skills, really.
You tell us that you describe his first faltering steps as a musician taking place with the banjo of all things, but then his attention shifts to the drums, and I think it's Christmas 1955 is given by his parents for as a Christmas gift some kind of secondhand drum kit, whatever that is, and that, of course, he takes off running rapidly after that. What do you want to tell us about his very earliest exploits on the drums and what seemed to be the draw for him?
Yeah, very funny, actually, because he by this time we should say that he had already was developing an interest in jazz music. He lived next door in Wembley, in North London, to a guy called Dave Green, who became his lifelong friend. Dave is still around. He's been fantastic for this book. He was so helpful to me in offering up his memories and some unseen photographs that we have in there. And they, rather improbably, as young men growing up in North London at a time when this music was not even that easy to hear, really, in the UK, but they both developed this amazing interest in and passion for jazz. And Charlie knew, as you say, there was that very early and very brief flirtation with the banjo, which was never going to last. He then made a makeshift drum out by using or cutting the neck off a banjo, would you believe? And that was his first very faltering steps. And then, as you say, he was given a secondhand drum kit by his parents, who bought it off the bloke in the pub down the road. And that became a Christmas present, I think. And he kind of never looked back, really. He just, in a very modest way, sort of taught himself, listened intently to these heroes, as they soon became, of American jazz music. Charlie Parker is the obvious one that people always talk about, but there's lots of other very important records by people like Earl Bostic and Miles Davis, of course, and the people if you got into a conversation with Charlie about jazz, that's the one time he would be truly animated. And he knew everybody who played on every session. complete jazz encyclopedia. With a passion that he, by his own admission, he didn't have for rock and roll. Jazz was always and remained his great love, and that really came through when you spoke to him. So, yes, just an early and lifelong passion.
When you are describing kind of his earliest exploration of music, one of the things that intrigued me the most was when we hear from him what he would do when he would visit local dance halls to experience the music. He said, "I never danced. I used to go and stand near the drummer and watch him play. And my favorite ones were invariably black Americans, and they played a music called jazz. That's what I wanted to play like." But that's just so interesting to think about somebody going into a dance hall where presumably nearly everybody is dancing excitedly, exuberantly, and there he is standing there just there to watch the drummer.
Yeah, that's right. I love it. You're quite right. It's he just knew that that's what he wanted to be part of, you know, and he often said to me and to, in other interviews that if he could have chosen a time and place, you know, to sort of teleport himself back, and it would have been, he would have chosen to be playing in one of those jazz clubs in New York around the probably the 40s or the 50s or wherever, you know, Birdland or somewhere like that. That would have been his absolute dream. And he came pretty close to that, of course, because he did play in a lot of those great jazz clubs later on. And his true love in the UK in terms of gigs, his absolute dream, as he said to me, was always to play at Ronnie Scott's club in London, where he would have gone as a you know, member of the audience, and then began to play there and in the other clubs of London of the turn of the 60s, basically. So yes, absolutely passionate about that.
So tell us about this Alexis Corner that Charlie Watts encounters around this time, and what an important encounter that is in terms of what would ultimately follow.
Yeah, I mean, Alexis is not always recognized as much as he should be for this incredible role that he played, this conduit that he was for so many musicians in London at that time, in a not dissimilar way to the role that John Mayall would play in the blues scene, just very slightly later than that. Alexis is one of those kind of talent spotters that of which there were a few at that time, who had a band called Blues Incorporated that was run by Alexis and a guy called Cyril Davis, and they just were this training ground really for up-and-coming musicians on what was an emerging rhythm and blues scene of 1962, that sort of period. And Charlie was on that circuit. You know, he came into Alexis's orbit. He was working abroad for a little while. Charlie had a spell, had some work, still as a graphic designer, in Denmark around that time. And when he came back, he found himself quite in demand for gigs, and it was really through Alexis that he met Brian Jones, first of all, and then Mick and Keith, and was really headhunted. You know, the Stones went after him, and eventually, after a little bit of a delay and some reluctance, where he was, because he was making quite good money as a designer, you know, and no one thought these jobs were going to last, of course. No one had any idea that this could go on till the end of the month, never mind the end of the year.
Exactly.
And here we are 60 years later talking about it, you know. It's very funny, you know. Keith was reminiscing about this, that and Mick as well, actually, that when they were talking to Charlie about the possibility of him joining the Stones, because they'd been going a few months by that point. Their first gig was in July of 62. And they finally got Charlie, and he did his first gigs with them 6 months later in the new year of 63. But his main reluctance, I mean, he was always down on his own ability. You know, he had this extraordinary thing which just never left him, where he didn't rate himself that highly. You know, he would always be putting himself down. And every time somebody told him how great he was, he just told them to stop being ridiculous. So there was a certain amount of doubt about his ability, but the main thing was that he was wondering whether they would be able to pay him enough money because, you know, at that time the Stones only had probably one regular gig a week. And at the point where they finally landed a second one around town, he thought, okay, I'll give it a try. I'm in. And that was that.
And the rest is history. We're speaking with Paul Sexton about his newest book called Charlie's Good Tonight, The Life, The Times, and The Rolling Stones, the authorized biography of Charlie Watts. Charlie Watts served as the primary drummer for the Rolling Stones for more than half a century. One of the things you share with us in terms of getting a sense of Charlie Watts settling in with Mick Jagger and Keith Richards in this brand new band is the fact that, as we've already touched on, Charlie Watts's first love was jazz. And you share with us an excerpt from one of Keith Richards's early diary accounts saying, "Charlie swings very nicely, but can't rock." Fabulous guy, though. So explain, particularly for, I'm a musician, but I'm not even sure I fully understand what it means when a drummer can swing, but he can't rock. Can you help us understand what that was and what needed to change in the way Charlie Watts played in order for him to become a true rock drummer?
Yeah, I'm glad you picked up on that that diary entry of Keith, because which he mentions in his own book, Life, that came out 10 or 12 years ago. And, you know, that I love it because it's kind of real-time reporting, isn't it, of you know, his pretty much first impressions on Charlie once he had joined. actually, I think what he was describing in it probably, without necessarily meaning to, was the very thing that made Charlie the player that he was. Because he came from jazz, he didn't come from, you have to imagine that at that time, obviously the first flush of rock and roll had been, and to some extent, gone. The Beatles are just about emerging on the scene at the same time as the Stones. There isn't really what you would call a rock and roll scene as such. It's the R&B circuit that is proving to be so important at that stage. So Charlie comes in with, you know, this very detailed knowledge of jazz recordings and artists. And I think the initial idea was that, you know, that might not have fitted exactly into what the Stones were doing, especially on stage. You know, the records that they started to make in 63 were one thing, but their gigs were pretty raucous affairs, you know, in some of the Eel Pie Club and other regular gigs that they started to play around town and developed this massive following. They were a pretty raucous R&B band, and yes, it did take Charlie a little while to get into the swing of that. But he brought a jazz sensibility to the group, which sets them apart. And if you listen carefully to the records, it is a very hard thing to quantify. And I don't speak as a drummer or as a musician, but I know from so many people that have work with him and, you know, have a far greater knowledge of it, that he was unique in the kind of subtlety that he brought to this fairly loud and raucous band who were, you know, emerging quickly on the scene. So it's just one of those things that I don't think even he would have been able to describe, really. It was such a second nature to him to play with a degree of subtlety and knowing when to be powerful but knowing when to hold back, and that I think is the thing that attracted the Stones to him in the first place. And it's something that only really developed as the years went by. And you know, if you can listen to Stones records of any vintage, including in later years, and it's just this effortless swing that he brings. And he didn't need to be loud. He had a very small kit. You know, that's another interesting thing. If you compare him to some of the other great rock and roll heroes on the drumming scene, whether it's John Bonham or Keith Moon, And they were all great mates. You know, they knew each other really well. But Charlie was a very different player to them. His basic drum kit was about 7 pieces, which is ridiculously small for a rock drummer. Huh. But it's all he needed.
Mm. One aspect of what he did with the Rolling Stones that you spend a fair amount of time talking about is the very special connection he had with the guy who was the bassist with the Rolling Stones for many, many years, a guy by the name of Bill Wyman. And you talk not only about the strong sort of musical connection between these two men, but also some of the interesting personality quirks that they also shared, which probably contributed to the really easy, profound chemistry that they had on all kinds of different levels. Describe to our listeners what I am talking about, this exceptional sense of connection between Charlie Watts and Bill Wyman.
Yeah, I mean, Bill in many ways is, you know, cut from the same cloth as Charlie. And as he said to me, you know, when we did the recent interview, one of the things that they really bonded over early on was the fact that they were both OCD. You know, he kind of spelt that out in terms, because Bill's attention to detail is very famous. He was always the historian in the band, who kept every receipt, knew every date, knew every payment that they'd been made or what they were still owed by people, you know, decades before. Charlie didn't do that, you know, but he didn't have that sort of material kind of level of detail. But he certainly had, some of the same characteristics as Bill. And the key thing was that they were both so extremely down to earth, and really had no interest in living the life that was, you know, rapidly beginning to open up in front of the others. They would really just kind of keep themselves to themselves and chat about the cricket or whatever. There's one particular story, if I may, I'll just mention quickly from this time, around the point where the Stones begin to break as an international group, as well as in the UK. On one of the very early tours, they, of course, as we know from all the footage that you see of the Stones and the Beatles and other bands, would always, wherever they were, whichever city they arrived in, they would be wheeled out for the obligatory press conference, often at the airport, actually, you know, where the press would assemble and ask routinely stupid questions of the band. I mean, there's wonderful footage of the Stones and the Beatles just making fun of some of those questions, of course. But they would, you know, unsurprisingly, in the Stones' case, those questions would be very much focused on the front, well, Mick in particular, and Keith and Brian. Bill and Charlie would really just kind of sit at the back, minding their own business, and just waiting for it to be over until I could finish. In one particular occasion, when the press conference was over, one of the representatives, either from the record company or might have been the person who ran the fan club, came over to Charlie, completely overwhelmed at the fact that she was even in the same room as them, and said, "Could you give me some sort of a memento of this?" And he went, "What do you mean?" And she said, "Oh, I don't know, just something for me to remember this occasion by." So he gave her the chair that he'd been sitting on and walked away. That's what he was like. He was just extremely matter-of-fact, probably wouldn't have even realized that was funny. He wasn't a joker in that sense. He was just unintentionally amusing. And, you know, Bill found that particularly hilarious, and they just had this lovely friendship that lasted, obviously for the rest of Charlie's life.
Hmm. One of my favorite points in the book is when they are having, I think it is Keith Richards primarily, who is kind of talking about what life is like when a band hits it big. Yeah. And when you are experiencing this, you know, trying to be musicians, but find yourself turning into rock stars and being viewed in that way, and that those two things, of course, are closely connected, but not at all the same thing. And, of course, this probably weighs especially heavily on somebody like Charlie Watts.
Yes, very much. He hated it completely, you know, and would always say there's a point where he's talking about that early hysteria, you know, that that followed the Stones from one place to the next. And he would, you know, again, you look back on some of this footage, it's true of the Beatles as well. Even in the film A Hard Day's Night with the Beatles, and it's true of there's a Stones documentary that I refer to in the book called Charlie Is My Darling, which is, captures the Stones at a fascinating point in on the road in 65. And you look at the kind of, I mean, now you would, there's just no protection for them at all. You know, it's just they're there, there's hardly any bodyguards or anybody around them. They're almost just thrown to the lions, really, you know, in terms of the fans getting super close to them. And he dreaded that. He would, as you said, he would hide in doorways to try and get away from that whole thing. And everything to do with the sort of machinations of their fame, you know, held no attraction for him at all. He loved, this is the contradiction, you know, he loved being, he was very, very proud of the Rolling Stones. He was very proud to be a member of the band, and he was extremely protective about their, you know, their reputation and their every aspect of what they did. He also loved performing, but every other thing that went around that, he pretty much hated. Didn't like traveling. Really didn't like interviews, unless they were about jazz. and there you have it. You know, just a very unusual man who spent, you know, 57 years or thereabouts doing something that was not ever his first choice.
Right.
So a strange life in many ways.
Yeah, you say it very well at one point when you write this. Charlie often came across as a bemused but benign traveler, making the best of a most unexpected life, swatting away unwanted attention as politely as his good manners would always demand. By the way, I think one really interesting moment in this particular chapter of the book is when you quote Charlie Watts himself comparing the Rolling Stones to the Beatles and what a typical Beatles performance was versus a typical Rolling Stones performance. And he gives praise to the Beatles for certain things, but then places the Rolling Stones squarely above the Beatles in at least one really important aspect. You remember the part in the book I'm talking about?
Yeah, that's right. And it's a theme you know, that we refer to a couple of times. Bill mentions this as well, you know, about the obviously they're rising at pretty much the same time. And would, in the very early days, impossible as it now seems to imagine, would be on the same bill, you know, for certain events. The NME poll winners concert, I think, in the one early stage. And, you know, Bill in particular would say that they were, he knows that his take on it was that the Beatles made better records, but that the Stones played you know, outplayed them on stage every time. And I think that might be fair. You know, it may sound a little dismissive, but I think that's something that they were particularly proud of, and I know Charlie was too. That you know, they could, in what were very limited circumstances in those days. Of course, you're talking about the very, very basic amplification and you know, stage facilities and so on. But yeah, he was, again, it's one of those areas where he was very proud of what the Stones stood for and what they achieved.
Absolutely. So one of the most important aspects of Charlie Watts' life is his family life, his life as a husband and as a father, ultimately a grandfather. And this is very, very important to him. And, of course, so much at odds with at least the public persona of, for instance, most of his bandmates. And for a lot of the people who are the most kind of notorious headliners in the world of rock and roll. And I appreciate the time you take to talk about his wife, Shirley, and the role that she played in his life.
Yes.
And in particular, the way in which she was very much her own woman, devoted to her husband, but also determined to keep him in line. Describe a little bit of the kind of the interesting dynamics at play in their marriage.
It's such a fascinating relationship. You know, they met at art school, excuse me, in about 1962. I think they got married in 64, and were devoted. You know, I mean, obviously every marriage has its ups and downs. That's inevitable. But they were together in every sense until Charlie's death last year. So 57 years. Shirley, very obviously, you know, as down to earth as he was in many ways, and. There's an early interview that I refer to, actually, where she talks about the fact that she loves being a Rolling Stones wife, even though, you know, and this is probably when they've only been married for a matter of months, that the only way for her to really see much of him was to go with them on the tours, you know, in those early days, which she continued to do on and off for many years to come. But, yeah, she just really, the polite way of putting it was that she wouldn't take any nonsense. You know, for all of his modesty, there were one or two occasions where Charlie would perhaps get a little bit carried away. There's a lovely story that was told to me by Tony King, who was a real Stones insider and part of their promotion set up for a very long time. And I got to know Tony quite well, you know, on the road where you would often do interviews. He was very close with Charlie and Shirley from very early on. He's the godfather of their daughter, and spent an awful lot of time with them from early days. And he recounted that one time Shirley wrote him a letter. People may remember letters. You know, this is the way that people used to communicate, of course. And she said in the letter, Charlie came home from the tour very full of himself for being, you know, being a member of the Rolling Stones. So I made him clean the oven. And it's one of those, quite a few of the reviews of the book have picked up on that story, because it's one of these, you know, things that you can sort of picture that are so completely incongruous with the sort of life that you imagine a rock star to be having. I mean, many people, you know, Serafina, his daughter, told me, he loved doing the washing up. He was so domesticated in later years. They were living on this in this very big place down in Devon where Shirley raised horses. And he would just be the kind of lord of the manor. You know, he'd dress up even if they weren't meeting anybody. Charlotte, his granddaughter, said she went down there one time and he was in the front room wearing a smoking jacket or something, and she said, but no one's coming, you're not seeing anybody. And he said, yeah, but, you know, he just thought it was important to look good wherever he was. So yes, combination of somebody with great style, not at all shy of spending money on himself and certainly on his friends, you know, very generous man indeed, but at the same time extremely domesticated and down to earth. And the OCD thing comes back into play there too, because someone describes one Christmas there where, you know, somebody would be unwrapping a present and he was so obsessively tidy that the wrapping paper could barely even touch the floor before he picked it up and thrown it away, tidied it away.
You devote an entire sort of special chapter. There are several special chapters that are called Backbeats, in which you examine a certain facet of his Charlie Watts's life and personality. And one of them, called 68 Inches of Style, explores his wonderful sense of style, which you say he began demonstrating already at the tender age of two.
That's right.
I want to spend just a moment to just talk about the fact that Charlie Watts, for nearly all of his adult life, was so very, very well-behaved, cultured, and gentlemanly, compared, again, to what we often kind of maybe carelessly think of as the typical rock star on rock tours and so on. There was a brief period in his life, I think it was back in the 1980s, you tell us, when he seems to have briefly experimented with drugs and alcohol, and you know, exhibited some alarming changes in appearance and personality before just discarding that altogether. You don't spend a lot of time talking about that, and I suspect maybe Charlie Watts himself maybe didn't talk about that an awful lot. But I only want to mention it mostly for the opposite side, which is so predominant in so much of his life. That is, his complete disinterest of any of those things that led so many other musicians down really destructive paths.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's something that even he himself never really understood. He described it as a midlife crisis. You're right, this was happening around 1986, and there was lots of contributory factors. His father had died a little while before that. The Stones were in a very bad place. You know, Mick and Keith were at the height of their fighting, really, and things were kind of falling apart. Obviously, the band didn't split, but they came as close as it's possible to do so. And I think he, you know, a level of boredom maybe is part of this, and even subconsciously, perhaps, the idea of imitating his jazz heroes, of course, because sadly, so many of them went down that path terminally, you know, and all those things came together, and for whatever reason, he decided that having been, you know, so sensible for so long, not that he wasn't a drinker, everybody was, you know, in the earlier days, but nothing heavier than that, but he really went to town and endangered his life, his marriage. And then, as you say, after a relatively short time, I mean, this is basically a period of about 2 years, really came to his senses. He had a fall at home one time, and I think he told me that he had a gig coming up at Ronnie Scott's, you know, soon after that, and it just made him think, what am I doing? You know, because he said he was going down to the cellar to get yet another bottle of wine or something. He had a fall, could easily have damaged his hands, you know, which are his livelihood, of course. And it just made him sit up, really, and not quite overnight, but just got himself together. No rehab, no fuss, no publicity. And again, his daughter is extremely proud of the fact that he did that, you know, that he just had the self-realization, another extremely rare quality among famous musicians, to pull himself back from the brink. And you know, from that point on, he changed completely. You know, he started to, I think he became vegetarian around that time, and just started living right, and had another sort of 35 years of amazing achievements after that.
And one of the things your book outlines is how Charlie Watts played a significant, if uncredited, role as kind of a design consultant for the Stones when they start to become incredibly big, and the scope and scale and spectacle of their performances just explodes in all kinds of different ways. And it is the dignified, unassuming Charlie Watts who has a very direct hand in much of the visual razzle-dazzle of what they are able to do, to say nothing of musically what they go on to achieve as well. Your book also explores his life as a collector, his generosity with family and friends, and then in a final chapter called The Long Road Home, which takes us through the last years of his life, his final Rolling Stones performance in the summer of 2019, and 2 years later, his death. I so appreciate the care with which you have told the story of Charlie Watts, and I suspect that after having done all this exploration of him and of his life, you come away admiring him as much as you did at the outset.
Yes, I think that's right, Greg. I mean, you know, it was such a pleasure to be able to dig deep into his story and, you know, to find things out about him. You know, I knew a lot going into this and had much of it from the man himself, you know, from so many conversations. But there's some nice detail in there for people to enjoy. And one thing I said at the very outset, actually, and there's a conversation with the publishers where I said that, you know, this will not be a sensationalist book in any way. You know, I think I say at the very beginning, if that's what you're looking for, then you're looking under the wrong stone, because his life was not like that. You know, it was all out there. Even the drug period is something that he, you know, had spoken about, including to me, on the very first time that we met, actually. So the point really was, you know, to pull together an affectionate summary of his life with the help of all of these people who've been around him for so long.
Mm. Well, it's a brilliant book. And again, it's titled Charlie's Good Tonight, The Life, the Times, and the Rolling Stones, the Authorized Biography of Charlie Watts, published by HarperCollins, with many, many photographs enhancing the beautiful work of author Paul Sexton. Paul Sexton, what a great pleasure to explore this book and to speak with you about it today on The Morning Show. What a great pleasure.
Greg,
Thank you so
pleasure.
Much.
Thanks so much. Thank you so much, Greg. And again, as I remember from our last conversation, you know, for reading it in such detail and, you know, saying nice things about it, of course. But I'm just glad you enjoyed it.
I really did.